an open Tosfot. Don't just think I'm making it up. Do it. Be sure everything is working.
Everything is rolling.
Rolling. Morty, do me a favor. See that all the lights are on. There's a problem with the lights. I just phoned in. But No. Turn. And the bottom. Okay. Yashikaya. There's a problem with lights. Okay. Let's begin because time is pressing. What can I tell you? Okay, Moshe, I'm happy to hear your wife is not working. Then you had a right to daven. All I can tell you in the Rabnid, if you're going to sing Hallel on Rosh Chodesh, you're going to be out of a job very quickly. That much I can assure you. Today is Monday, February 11th, 2013. And let me begin the class. It's a sad day today because someone I know for since 1951 is being buried later this morning. And of course I'm talking about David Hartman. And I can't do any better than read to you from a classic volume which has sold as a bestseller, maybe a few hundred copies. But that's probably done a little better. But according to the report I get on the royalties, they charge me for transportation, anything to do with the book. I'm lucky they don't charge me. I'm lucky I don't owe them something. Anyway, on page 50, 51, I talk about the great students I met when I entered the yeshiva in 1951. David Hartman, Aaron Lichtenstein, and Gershon Sadowski. Hartman was known as Divi, and he was constantly encouraging the younger students to be more punctilious in their religious practice. He came to IU after years of study at Yeshiva Rabbi Chaim Berlin in Brooklyn and the Beit Midrash Gavoa in Lakewood, New Jersey. One day in 1953, Divi entered the Beit Midrash and very dramatically entreated us to rend our garments and sit down on the floor. When we looked at him in shock, he informed us that the Chazon Ish, Avraham Yeshaya Karelitz of Bnei Brak, had just passed away. We did not comply with Divi's requests, but we certainly internalized the pain upon the loss of this eminent sage. And that's the way I want to remember David Hartman. The Rav, I always tell this to my grandchildren. My grandchildren complain that they say to me, Saba, we're 20X, Echmeis 25, 27, 24. You treat us like we're youngsters. And I say to them, first of all, you'll never understand what I'm about to tell you until you are a grandfather. But I say over from the Rav, Habein Yakiri Li Ephraim Yelid Shashuim Midei Davri Brol Zachach Eskarena Rachem Arachamenu Od. And the Rav would always say, if not for that pasuk, tshuva would not be impossible. Because we come to God, I don't have to tell you what goes on in the world. We grow up, we grow smarter than God, smarter than Torah, smarter than religion, smarter than our Rebbeim. And we do all types of sins. But the Ribbono Shel Olam is merciful. He remembers us as youngsters, as blameless, sinless, sincere children. And it's a fabulous thought. Habein Yakiri Li Ephraim. That's the way God sees us. And that's the way I remember Divi Hartman. I'll go one step further and we'll leave this for future generations to decide. I once heard the Rav 50 years ago at the Moriah. So he was eulogizing a Balabas. And Balabas, I don't know who the man was, Reb Nassim Shub. But from the Rav's hesped, I gathered this individual had run away from Hitler, had been in many different countries, Polish origins, Belgium, Holland, England, America. And the Rav spoke in terms of a noun and an adjective. And he said, the adjectives change. You know, in life, you go through so many different stages, and the Rav started speaking about himself, and it's just fabulous. He says, you know, at times I had a beard, didn't have a beard. At times I wore rabbinic garb. At times I changed. At times I wore a long bekesher on Shabbos. And he said, all these adjectives changed so many different times in my life because I was exposed to so many different influences, so many different cultures. But what's most important, that the noun, the shem etzem, etzem ha'adam, that cannot change. And that's the way he eulogized this Mr. Shub, that with all that he went through in life, but the essence in the individual did not change. Spoke different languages, various times in life, dressed differently. His whole lifestyle varied where he was. But the essence of the individual did not change. And of course, we all know with Rabbi Dr. Professor David Hartman that he certainly went through many different changes in life. Exposed to many different cultures. You can imagine from Lubavitch to Chaim Berlin to Lakewood to YU and the rabbinate, the Bronx, who I yet was in his shul, remember it vividly, Montreal, Jerusalem, and all our quests and difficulties and challenges here, Alat Mata Kodesh, challenges that we live until this very moment, this very second, I should say. And I hope that the judgment will come down that the basic individual, the mahut, the soul, the commitment, was not altered by all these adjectives that changed from year to year, from decade to decade. Yehi zichro baruch. Okay. Now, I want to make one small correction. I mentioned Charlie Batt in class, and I mentioned that Rabbi Batt was from New Haven. Correct that to Hartford, Connecticut. To me, when I talk about north of New York, it's all the same, but that's a different problem. But I just want to make that small correction. And let us begin. It's a very important shiur today. Rabbi Rubin, you started in yesterday's shiur. You asked the question that sent me thinking, and you should listen to where I discuss it in shiur, because it's a question that hangs fire. I mean, when you're a kid in high school, every question has to have an answer. When you're an adult who has gone through life and changed many adjectives about how you acted and how you lived and how you dressed and interacted, the languages you spoke, not every question has an answer. And the whole attitude we have to have towards Professor Atlas hangs fire. But this was the whole debate, and you'll hear what I have to say about Acher and the question you raised, which was very profound, and it troubled me, and you'll hear what I say, the question I raise and the answer I propose beyond. Okay, Bernard Revel, the miracle that a man like Bernard Revel lived, that a man like Bernard Revel existed, it was absolutely a miracle. The yeshiva has shifted gears. There's a new generation of Balabatim. It's a generation of Balabatim who speak English, who have succeeded in America, who recognize the importance of education. The East European is Americanizing. The melting pot is having its influence. A rabbi like Rabbi Bernard Leventhal, there is no question that Rabbi Leventhal was the most, as they called him, quote, the most Americanized of the European rabbis in America. And Rabbi Leventhal would have become president in Rosh Yeshiva in 1909, 1910, but the Balabatim in Philadelphia didn't want him to leave. And you have to remember, this was a time when the rabbinate in America was a very prestigious institution, when the Orthodox rabbinate were the leaders of Torah Jewry in the United States and Canada. It is different from today, as we will see next year. Today there have been radical changes, and the rabbi has nowhere near the influence of Rosh Yeshiva, of so-called Gedolei Yisrael. It's a different ballpark today. But we're talking 100 plus years ago, and Rabbanim were all over the United States, East Europeans, whether they were religious or not religious, if they were still Shomer Shabbos, not Shomer Shabbos, but the Rav they admired and looked up to was a Europeish Rav who could speak Yiddish and obviously already knew some English. But the search began, and Rabbi Revel is in America. You heard last week's shiur, ran away from Europe, genius ability, gets involved with socialism, anarchism, Bundesism, arrested, revolutionary. Was he religious at the time? Wasn't he? Nobody has the answer. I would venture an educated guess that he was religious, simply because in my research I found that there were people who became great socialists who remained religious. And all of you know, when the first government was established following the initial revolution, the first minister of finance of what later becomes the communist empire was a Shomer Shabbos Jew. Yes, it's true, when communism took over with full force, he had to emigrate to the United States, and it was a dream that he had to leave behind. Why do I say that? Because I believe his name was Krensky. It has to be checked. I don't recall the name offhand. I never really did real research on him, but I know in passing that what I just said to you is correct, that the first minister of finance was a Shomer Shabbos Jew. He spoke with Rabbanim what he should do on Shabbat if there's an emergency, and I believe they gave him the same etzah, the sign with his left hand. I think it's the same etzah they gave Lou if an emergency comes up, to do everything with your left hand. It's an unbelievable thought, but what strengthens my supposition is when Rabbi Revel came to America, the first place he went was to Reitz. And the fact that he went to the yeshiva and not to Abe Kahn with the forwards and with socialism shows you that the basic gestalt of the Torah Jew, of the Talmud Chacham, remained with him. And that's my educated guess. Now, the shidduch is fabulous. And I want to mention again something I mentioned a while ago. I don't think I mentioned it last week. But we owe Shmuel Chabad a vote of thanks. Why? Because the Travis family was a Lubavitch family that had emigrated to the United States. But their commitment, their gestalt religiously animated from Chabad, from Lubavitch. And that was a fabulous shidduch. Here's a girl growing up in Marietta, Ohio, a very pious lady. She went, there was no yeshiva, there was no day school. How many Jews were there in Marietta? How many from Jews were there? They didn't even have a full-time rabbi, with Rabbi Zivitz of Pittsburgh, who would visit occasionally. And as she told me, and you see this many times, that if you grow up in a totally non-Jewish environment, you go out of your way to be very pious. And Rabbi Zivitz talking with Rabbi Leventhal and this young man, Rabbi Revel, and they made the shidduch between Sarah and Bernard Revel. They get married in 1909, and that shidduch gave Rabbi Revel the ability to be financially independent. It worked as a positive aspect and a negative aspect. The positive was financial independence. He took no salary from the yeshiva, total dedication. The negative aspect, that he could never devote himself fully to the yeshiva in the initial years because he was constantly on call by the family to go back, help out in Tulsa, the oil business. There were terrible problems with Rockefeller, with Standard Oil, with illegal practices, and Rabbi Revel was on call to help his family. Now, they come to New York, and the first big achievement, which today you don't realize how major it is, the first yeshiva high school organized in the United States. I cannot say in the world, because in Lida, in Lithuania, or White Russia, you already had Yeshiva Torah Vadas, organized by Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Reines, Talmud of Volozhin, founder of the Mizrahi, great religious Zionist, and he had already organized a yeshiva high school. But in the United States, this was a great achievement. September 3rd, 1916, Rabbi Revel opened the doors of Talmudical Academy on the Lower East Side of New York, Montgomery Street, a organized high school. Now, this was a fabulous achievement. And listen very carefully to what I'm about to tell you, because this is going to come to play in a few weeks' time. I will talk about an incident in Yeshiva's history that I was enjoined from speaking about. But I think at the end of 50, 60 years, for the sake of tomorrow, let me tell the truth and let me explain what I have to explain and give the answer to a question I've been asked 1,000 times, but less and less as years went by and people departed the world who forgot what happened in 1935. And a lot of my understanding and answer, which I believe to be totally correct or 99% correct, no one can say total except the Ribbono Shel Olam, goes back to what I'm about to tell you now, although you will just take innocent sounding information. How do you organize a high school? What do you mean you organize a high school? What do you know about a high school? You're coming from Europe. You never went to gymnasium. Think of Rabbi Revel. Think of the Rav. Did the Rav ever go to a formal gymnasium? All right, he had the... Perhaps he did externals. He had the equivalent of a gymnasium degree. But you have to know what you're doing. And this is New York City. There were laws and regulations. This isn't the Tsar, or it isn't Satmar of today, and I hope maybe their power is being mitigated now, where you can pay off city officials, look the other way. This is a high school. Aye, they don't have 1 minute of general subjects and boys and girls come out of the high school speaking a broken English. Today, Satmar has power. They vote on block. Mr. City official, you want our votes? Don't interfere with what we do. You're a nice boy. Next election, 35,000 votes come your way. Because the Rebbe is going to say, Mr. McGillicuddy was nice to us. This is 1915, 1916. How do you organize a high school? So Rabbi Revel had to seek out people who, number one, had advanced degrees, knew what a high school was about, knew what a college was about, knew what the Board of Regents was about, knew what the city statutes were about, knew how to organize a high school. Secondly, he had to seek out people who cared about Judaism. This was going to be a unique high school. It's not a general high school, a secular high school. It's not a Catholic high school. This is a Jewish high school, a yeshiva high school. Where do you find Shomrei Shabbat who have PhDs? Who are involved in education. Today, if you advertised in the New York Times, within a half hour, you would have 1,001 emails from Shomer Shabbos educators with every advanced degree in the world looking for a position. But this is 100 years ago. It's not today. So, first of all, he got the few Shomer Shabbos people who had advanced degrees and who remained from. And remember, this is an ongoing debate. Professor Steiner never lets Professor Hagrach, Dr. Grach Soloveitchik, my classmate, forget it. Professor Soloveitchik, Dr. Grach, whatever name you know him by, my classmate Chaim, he's a genius of geniuses. I discussed that with you already. I told you what Rabban Soloveitchik had to say about his nephew. He's a genius, period. All of Brisk is in his head. And he wrote a brilliant article, besides all his research, all his Chachmat Yisrael, on a sociological level, rupture and reconstruction. But the thrust of the article, of course, was that in America, there was a rupture. Everyone came to America from people, and America corrupted them. And what remained, and it had to be reconstructed, and this is the Baal Tshuva movement, and it's all, I don't have to go any further. Whoever heard of a Jew sitting down to the Seder with a napkin that indicates how much matzah he has to eat? Sitting down with a napkin that's marked off and shows him how much romaine lettuce he has to eat. Whoever heard of such things? You knew about matzah, you knew about matzah, you did what your father did, you did what your grandfather did. But we're living in a generation where the children have to lead the parents. So you need a napkin, there's no one to tell you, you need a measurement. I've seen it with my own eyes. Hashem Yirachem. It's unbelievable, but Rabbi Steiner makes the Professor Steiner, I should say, it's not Rabbi, Professor Mark Steiner makes the point, and published an article, and others published, that there was a remnant in America where there was never any rupture. And there were. I find the middle ground. I say Chaim is essentially right. 90% assimilated, but there was a 10% that remained strong. I mean, look at Morty Tarrigan, his grandchildren, direct descendants of Rabbi Bernard Illaway. We're going back 150 years or more. No, that defeats Chaim's thesis. Not really, because you're the exception that proves the rule. Do you understand? This is the way you have to view it. So first of all, Dr. Solomon Horowitz was a Jew who grew up in America and had advanced degrees and was on the faculty of Columbia University. And from what I gather from my research, he was a Shomer Shabbos Jew. And he helped organize. There was Rabbi David Stern. Some of you recognize the name. He had a master's in mathematics. He later is very active in helping to organize Masifta Torah Vadas. So you had some people who were really Shomer Shabbos 100% and loved the idea that there would now be a yeshiva high school. In addition, Rabbi Revel had to reach out to people who were not Shomer Shabbos, but at least kept the connection to the East European Jew, appreciated their quests, their difficulties. And here I want to mention one name among those who helped organize the high school, teach in the high school, Dr. Shelley Safier. Let me give you his original name. Dr. Shelley, this is a very important name in yeshiva's history. Not at this moment in time, but much later. The original name, S-A-F-I-R, Safier. It's a beautiful Hebrew name, Dr. Shelley Safier. What was unique about him? He is an East European boy who grew up in the east side of New York, who achieved a PhD from Columbia University. If my memory is correct, and I think my memory is correct, and we kids in MTA many decades later used to laugh and be hysterical because his PhD thesis was, quote, end quote, on the asexual reproduction of the tsetse fly, end the quote. Check it out. I repeat it again. Shelley Safier, Columbia University, early part of the 20th century, PhD thesis in biology on the asexual reproduction of the tsetse fly. Now, unfortunately, antibiotics were not in the vogue. An influenza epidemic hit New York in 1918. Thousands died. Among them was Dr. Horowitz. Shelley Safier then became the principal of the high school. And, excuse me, yes?
They allow non-Jewish faculty?
No. If they always had non-Jewish faculty. But when the high school was organized, there was non-Jewish. I don't believe there was non-Jewish faculty, because you only needed how many teachers? 6, 7. I can give you all the names. They're all Jewish names. I don't want to bore you with details. But there's a reason why I singled out Shelley Saphir, and he takes Dr. Horowitz's place. And those two perhaps were the only ones that had PhDs of the initial faculty. Everyone else had a master's degree. With the college, if not for the non-Jews who were world famous, they wouldn't have gotten accreditation. Of course they had non-Jews. But the underlying theme was anyone who taught at yeshiva and yeshiva college, TA, and the college afterwards, they were philo-Semites. Either they were Jews, observant, or Jews who had feeling for a Jewish institution, or non-Jews who felt they were doing a good deed in helping organized advanced learning for religious Jewish boys. Now, 3 years later, Rabbi Revel achieved the dream, and the TA was officially accredited, and the first graduating class took place. 3 years, they were able to do the entire program, pass the regents, do very well on exams of a citywide basis or a statewide basis, and TA was on the map. But notice, and this opens up in the history of the yeshiva, a fascinating Pandora's box. During this entire period, Rabbi Revel does not take a penny. But Rabbi Revel is constantly communicating between Tulsa and New York. By the late 1910s, Standard Oil is using unfair practices to gain a monopoly in the petroleum field. They're not only producing petroleum, but they buy up the railroads that deliver petroleum, and they give special prices to their own people and charge a fortune to outsiders. These practices were later declared illegal. But while becoming Standard Oil, they knocked out one after another private individuals who were trying to compete with them. The more they succeeded, the more time Revel had to spend in Tulsa. You cannot run a yeshiva long distance. So in his absence, or in the absence which was at first 2 months a year, 4 months a year, ultimately the majority of the year, he was in Tulsa. And I actually found records in my research, correspondence. Can't run a yeshiva long distance. While this was happening, in 1917, the Mizrahi organization organized a teachers' institute in New York. Now, what am I talking about? Who is in New York? Who remembers my lectures on Mizrahi a few years ago, when I spent 10 years answering questions, Ellie, that my students have asked me? Rabbi Meir Berlin? Rabbi Meir Berlin, the younger brother of Reb Chaim Berlin, 48 years younger. Never forget that, Reb Chaim Berlin. Rabbi Meir Berlin writes in his memoir, Von Volozhin Biz Yerushalayim, he writes in his memoir that his older brother was like his grandfather. Don't get frightened, it was two different wives. 48 years to have children consecutively is beyond human reality. But of course, Reb Meir Berlin, Reb Meir Bar Ilan later, was born from the Netziv's niece, who was his second wife. Reb Meir Berlin comes to America, he organizes Mizrahi after World War II, after World War I, as I explained years ago, Mizrahi goes on the map. People become Zionists. People don't give a hoot about Zionism. Eli calls man. They you know, life is good. What's wrong? Ah, but World War I, Yoni, they become Mizrahiites. Now, what was the vehicle of education in America? Where did I begin teaching in 1959? When I go around boasting like an idiot that I'm teaching Torah 54 years, I haven't worked a day in my life. All right, should Rakefet boast like that? What is he, a dummy, proud of the fact that he hasn't made a living 54 years? Can I in Hara? All right, maybe I should boast. I don't know. Leave it to you to decide. Where did I begin teaching 54 years ago? Hebrew school. Those days, I told you, we had no kollel. The yeshiva kicked you out at 23. Either you knew how to learn or you didn't know how to learn. If you didn't know how to learn by 19, finish. You're never going to learn how to know how to learn. Today, at 19, you can barely open up a Schottenstein. By the time you're 22, Baruch Hashem, you have finished 10 volumes of Schottenstein. I looked this morning in Shul. We have the Schottenstein in Hebrew, in memory of Professor Abraham Goldberg, Zeichet Tzadik Livracha. What an achievement. But I have to be honest, for my purposes, nothing equals Sansino. You follow me, Sam? I get a difficult word. I go crazy with Schottenstein. 50 pages, one page of Gemara, this, that, the lines. Give me a Sansino, finished. Done, 1 minute, I got the word, he knows, I find Sansino. What burns me up with Sansino, and then I take a look, Schottenstein's the Zelbazach, they're words in Hebrew, they just transliterate. They also don't know what the word means. They're transliterating it. They have a footnote, they start guessing. Okay, they're no smarter than I am. No, Hebrew school was the vehicle, that's the way kids got their education. There were no day schools, there were no yeshivas. You went to Hebrew school Sunday morning, and 2 to 3 afternoons a week. If you went to a real serious Hebrew school, you went 5 days a week. But I remember like yesterday. Now, where do you get teachers? Who is doing the teaching in America? I told you, read Washington. Lo yutzlachnakim. Someone came to America. He tried to make a living. He was an idiot. He went bankrupt. No, he remembered in sein Jugend, in his youth, he learned a little Gemara. He knows how to teach up a Chumash. He's a Mechallel Shabbos, but he knows a little bit. He becomes the teacher. And this was true in every day school, in every yeshiva. Harry Merrilis writes about his teachers. After he read my book, he said, Rakefet is right. Tova Lichtenstein, why did she speak about in public? The whole book, what was it worth? The way I grew up. Yosef Tzadik Mendelovich at the book launch, he says, everyone thinks what interests me is what Rakefet writes about Russia. What interests me is what he writes about the way he grew up. It was amazing. The least important part of my book attracted the most attention. All right, now with the book coming out in Hebrew, B'nativ HaDamama, maybe my book becomes more valuable with what we did in Russia. I hope so, Shmuel. Anyway, Rabbi Berlin was very smart. We got to produce Hebrew teachers. This can't go on. We can't have the future generation being educated by lo yutzlachnikim who don't give a hoot about Yiddishkeit and about Zionism and barely know what they're teaching and are not really interested or equipped. We have to raise a generation of teachers. And in 1917, Mizrahi organizes a teachers seminary. Teachers Institute under the auspices of the Mizrahi. Rabbi Meir Berlin, tremendous visionary. Daniel, there's only one problem here. You can have many visionaries. I'll give you an example. Rabbi Chaim Bravender, you've heard the name? Okay. Rabbi Chaim Bravender, BTA graduate, classmate of Rabbi Steve Riskin. The most innovative educator you could ever imagine. Do a biography of him. You know how many different schools he organized? Lindemann and Bravender's and this and that. Not an administrator. Rabbi Riskin, administrator par excellence. Fabulous. People have different qualities. And you know, at one point, Rabbis Bravender and Riskin merged, And everyone said this is a fabulous merger. Rabbi Brabender with his insight and innovativeness, and Rabbi Riskin with his administrative down-to-earth ability. Like all good Jews, that merger broke up, and Rabbi Brabender today is, I think, semi-retired. He has something on the website, and Rabbi Riskin's institutions, of course, continued to function, and the Brabender's Lindenbaum, what did I call it today? Lindenbaum, I think, if I have it right. I think he also played a role in Japan. Terrific guy, Brabender. But not a man who can administer on the ground. Understand? The Teachers Institute that Rabbi Berlin organized was a fabulous idea. But who could administer it? Rabbi Berlin was having his own difficulties running Mizrahi. Mizrahi were not the greatest administrators. Just because an organization has fabulous ideas, you see what happens. Look at the OU today in the year 2013. Look at the OU today. Place is shaking. I got to give credit. Two people pulled aside, and they're going to elect by acclamation a new president from the West Coast and let him turn everything over and start anew, start afresh. By the way, remember, I'm not talking about the kashrut. The kashrut is not affected at all by what goes on in the floor above it. Be aware. The kashrut runs under Rabbi Ganak. Rabbi Ganak is the czar. And if you talk about an administrator, Talmud Chacham par excellence, it's Rabbi Menachem Ganak. But the upstairs, Balabatim, not everyone who's elected president, everyone who they think a rabbi will be a good executive director to administer, you need someone who's a genius at administration. Look back at the history of TA, the greatest administrator in the world. Ask your grandparents. Norman B. Abrams. Did he have a degree? I don't even know if he graduated high school. But Norman B. Abrams, wow. This was an administrator. Huh? What does this have to do with yeshiva? So while Rabbi Revel is not around, they have to find a new president. They bring in Rabbi Berlin, becomes president of the board of directors. They bring in Rabbi Israel Rosenberg, one of the most prominent rabbanim on the East Coast of New York, big leader in the Agudas HaRabbanim. He becomes the Rosh Yeshiva. And while Rabbi Revel is not there, 1920-21, that school year, they bring Teachers Institute and make it part of the yeshiva. They put it under the auspices of what today is Yeshiva University. Now, this is a fascinating moment. And it opens a Pandora's box of dialogue, debate, and discussion. What am I talking about? You see, until now, Sam, you have Yeshiva Shebzichol Chanun. It has a high school. But when it comes to Limudei Kodesh, all you have is a yeshiva. In later years, Chaim Berlin will have a high school. Terev Adas will have a high school. Satmar Torah V'Yira has to have a high school. Lakewood's branch in Philadelphia, in Stamford, Connecticut, have high schools. Required, needed, necessary. No one has a negative word to say against Lakewood in Philadelphia, Stamford, Connecticut, St. Louis, Montreal, Los Angeles, Chicago, Tells, Yeshiva Gavoa, everyone has a high school. Could you imagine if Yeshiva had stopped at this point, has a high school, might even have a college? But the Limudei Kodesh are all yeshivas, Rabbeinu, Yitzhak, Elchanan, on the highest level possible. It's America, so we have to have a high school, we have to have a college. But that's it. Could you imagine had the yeshiva developed on that level, on that plane, on that line? Could very well be that no one in the world would have a negative word to say about Yeshiva University. Even in Lakewood, even in Mir, even in Ger, even in Satmar. Yeshiva, like all the yeshivot, but just like every other yeshiva has a high school in the United States of America, we have a high school too. North America, it's not Eastern Europe. The government intervenes. You must, to what age in Canada do you have to go to school? What is it, 18? 16? Wow, I think in New York it's 17. They're a year ahead of Canada. Ah, they brought in Teachers Institute. This is not Yeshivas Reb Yitzchok Hanan. Teachers Institute. A much different curriculum. Subjects. Tanakh. Nachim Mefarshim. Medabrim Ivrit. Hatzaot B'Ivrit. Chochmat Yisrael. Medrash. Navi. Torah HaYehudim. Machshevet Yisrael. V'gam Ksat Gemara. Who ever heard of these subjects? In a real yeshiva? You have a Rebbe teaching Medrash? Chochmat Yisrael, scientific approach, Dr. Kaplan taught, Dr. Klotz. These were famous names. Dr. Zeitlin, Solomon Zeitlin. Where did they teach, if not the Teachers Institute? You have broadened the base. You have changed the course of development of the yeshiva. What type of students do you attract? Well, who knows the stories? What kids go to yeshiva? You had kids coming, not because they wanted Yiddishkeit, not because they wanted Torah, because their parents were bending their ears, mein Sohn, ihr muss gehen und lernen in a yeshiva, you have to go, you don't have a choice. So the kids yelled and shouted, I don't give a hoot about them. I'm an American kid. I want to make a living. I want to go to college. I want to go to graduate school. I want to be a MD. I want to be a PhD. I want to conquer the world. All right, Mom, I'll do you a favor. I'll go to Teachers Institute. They have a broader curriculum. No, you end up with kids. Mechalel Shabbos. Mechalel Shabbos. Dean Zahar always used to tell the story. I was very close. Dean Zahar had tremendous insight. Shmuel Leib Zahar, recognized the name. He was Rabbi Rebel's right hand afterwards. Then Rabbi Belkin took over. I told you, Rabbi Dean Zahar went said to me, the more titles they give me, the less influence I have in the yeshiva. He became dean of students. He was a clever Litvish kid. And I told you how he died, remember? No one ever died like that. If you have to plead with the Ribbono Shel Olam how to die, this is the way to go. 1 year after I got smicha in 1962, they had a little party in the yeshiva to celebrate the next smicha class. It was not a chag ha-smicha, a yearly little convocation. So in the Beis Medrash, Dean Zahar is chairing it, gets up to speak, introduces it, says Divrei Torah, this is what you call the Harry Fishel Beis Medrash, and right after he finishes speaking, keels over, and on the spot, in the Beis Medrash, he gives back his neshama to the Kaddish Baruch Hu. It's unbelievable. his daughter, Shidlivin Bewell, lives in Yerushalayim. They moved to a senior citizens a year or two ago. They used to live opposite Rabbi Rubin. She's Mrs. Zuroff. She was dean of students at Stern College for many, many years. So Pinzah tells the story. He meets a kid from Teachers Institute mailing a letter on Shabbos. And he said the kid didn't even know. He said he said to the kid, you know, you're not allowed to carry on Shabbos. There was no air. And he said the kid didn't even know it was forbidden or didn't care. He wrote the letter on Shabbos, but he apologized to Dean Zoff for carrying it and mailing it. When I lived in Lakewood, I remember there was a family there that cursed Yeshiva with a passion because this woman had married a Lakewood boy, and her brother went to T.I. and he's a Mechalel Shabbos, and it broke his parents' heart. All right, blame it on T.I. It was the times, the circumstances. But once you open the yeshiva to T.I., oh, wait a minute. Then you can open the yeshiva, a college, Bernard Revel Graduate School, Albert Einstein Medical School, Stern College for Women? Do you understand what I'm saying? The breach has been made. Wow, what went on when Stern College was organized? And then endless graduate schools. Then you have Yeshiva University. No? Rabbi Avadya Yosef said it openly. Who are we? What are we? What he said about Jews like myself living here, they say it in the United States, except they say it in Yiddish. Rav Avadya said it in modern Hebrew. Goyim. Abanda Goyim. You understand what I'm saying? And it all begins with the Teachers Institute. Now, Teachers Institute has undergone many, many changes. You can do an entire book. I don't even know what it's called today. What's it called? It was called at one time the Breuer School. Ugh, it went under so many different names, and now Teachers Institute is part and parcel. It's like a Beis Medrash program part time with a few more classes. It's not the Yeshiva program. Yeshiva program has more Talmud, but it's part and parcel of the Yeshiva. And if you can organize Teachers Institute, you can organize a Jewish studies program. The Mechina, don't they have it today? At one time, YU used to boast that they have more kids that they have made from than Lubavitch. In the 1970s, they used to make that boast. I don't think it can be made today, because in the 70s, Lubavitch was still relatively small. Today, Lubavitch is the world. What need I say? It is the world. But it's fascinating that because Rabbi Revel was in Tulsa, this all happened, and what an impact it has on the future development of what today is Yeshiva University, the flagship of centrist orthodoxy, modern orthodoxy. But if you ask Rakefet, Chas v'Chalila, you should describe him in those terms. The flagship of orthodoxy in Western context. I do not put an adjective on the Shem Etzem orthodoxy. Remember what I said an hour ago about Rabbi David Hartman and his life. Ready? Okay. I have to get ready. Let me try my best, because this is very, very emotional for me. Of all that Rabbi Revel did, organizing the high school, the money problems in his personal life, allowing in Teachers Institute, which, when all is said and done, is probably a very positive achievement when viewed with the passage of time and what ultimately comes out of yeshiva as a result of Teachers Institute. Nothing compared to what he did in relationship to Rietz, a formal rabbinic program. And here you have to understand, we have no tradition of formal rabbinic programs. How many of you learned in Volozhin? I learned in Volozhin, 1860s, 1870s. You wanted to get smicha. They looked at you. What are you, a sinner? What's this? Torah shelol lishma? The only way you were allowed to study for smicha, and even that had to be clandestinely, not in the main base medrash, was when you became engaged to a rav's daughter. And it was known that you would inherit your father-in-law's position. All right, you're going to inherit a rabbanis, you have medav kenin paskinin, you have to have a paskinin shayla. So, you went and studied your adaya, you took exams, and you all know people boast who they have smicha from. Rabbi Professor Tarigan, who his grandfather has smicha from. You all know that in the Kollel, maybe 20 years ago, we had a whole ceremony where Rabbi Lessen's grandson gave me copies of Rabbi Lessen's smichat in return for a copy I gave him of the smicha that Rabbi Lessen gave me. He did it privately, quietly. Of course, with the modern world, a new concept developed, particularly in Germany, Hungary, Central Europe, rabbinical seminaries. And I lectured about this 10 years ago already. It's not for now, but I'll say hamazlek, if you know modern Hebrew. What are rabbinical seminaries? They were seminaries, utilitarian, pragmatic. You came in to Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary. It was 100% orthodox in the full sense of the word. Torah and Derech Eretz. There were no shortcuts. But it was an organized program. 10 hours a week, Talmud. 4 hours a week, codes. 2 hours a week, Tanakh, elocution, Jewish history, Jewish philosophy, theology. At the end of 6 years, you would qualify for rabbinic ordination if you had a PhD from a neighboring university. And you knew, al rachel bitcha ktana, to use the rabbinic aphorism, each year what you studied, what you had to do, what exams you had to pass. When Rietz began, it began like a European yeshiva, like Volozhin, like Slobodka, like Telz, like Panovich, like Mir, bim gesitztem gelernt. You sat, you learned. There was no clock to punch. There was no curriculum. You learned what you wanted. You should know that in Volozhin, they learned Shas al Hasedah. If you wanted every day, there was a shir on the daf. It was an amazing system there. In addition, they picked the Masechet, Noshim, Nezikim, the Rosh Hashiva said Shayurim. No clock. You could learn 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. It's like Lakewood today. Where do you have a curriculum? Like Mir. What curriculum? When curriculum? Chaburat on top of Chaburat. You learn what you want. You stay as many years as you want. Fine. Rabbi Revel, my cousin, reorganized Rietz. For the first time, it would be a yeshiva, but it would have some of the overtones of a seminary. Your adaya would be available as an official subject. Elocution would be available. Public speaking. At first, Rabbi Rebbe was opposed to teach Medrash. And the students put up a sign. I write about it in Revel. Saying Rabbi Revel's opposed to teach Medrash and he proves his point with the Medrash. Why can't we know how to utilize a Medrash? And Rabbi Revel said, paraphrasing the Gemara in Baba Metzia, Daf Nuntet, Nitzchuni Banai Nitzchuni. And they introduced Midrash with elocution. And this is very important. I learned this from the Rav. I learned how to speak from the Rav. I'm not ashamed to say I can get up in front of an audience and throw around the Midrash and imitate the Rav. All right, I'm a poor imitation. But I can imitate the Rav. The old timers who hear me say to me, ach, they know where I'm coming from. I had to sit the Sikkur, but if you don't sit with the Rav, you don't hear the Rav. You mean you got to hear the public addresses. Yitzchak, I trust you heard the Rav in Boston. You know what I'm talking about. Saturday night, what he could do with a Midrash. Wow. Particularly the 50s when he, in Yiddish.
75th anniversary of Maimonides School.
Wow.
So I was there.
Wow. So
they had three speakers. One was from the class of 2012. Year 1990, and my year was 1956.
Where was this?
At the Begin Center.
Very nice. And Rabbi Meir Twersky is here now, Rabbi. Was he there?
No, Tobel was there.
Tobel, very nice. Very nice. Ah, Maimonides, that is an achievement. I'm sure in America they did something probably much bigger. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. But you need a Midrash. You have to know how to preach. You have to know how to speak. You don't know from a Daf Gemara, from a Sugin Shas and Paiskim and going through a Rambam and arrive at it. Doesn't mean you know how to handle a Midrash. And Rabbi Revel reorganized the yeshiva. And in March 23rd, 1919, it's a red letter day in the history of yeshiva, they had a public smicha convocation for the first time. Five rabbanim received smicha. What makes these rabbanim unique? It was rabbanim who learned most of their learning on American soil. Until now, tens and tens got smicha. How did they get smicha? They came to read. Same shame galerin feel galerin. I'm sorry. I break into Yiddish. I'm sorry. It's my native Torah language. I struggled very hard to learn Yiddish. I'm a third generation American, but I either you swim or you sink, because 51 all of Torah learning in America on a level was in Yiddish. So I apologize. Remind me if I break into Yiddish. Stop me, and I'll go back to English.
What was the school called? Called
Talmudic Academy. That's the high school, but Reitz remains Reitz. This is Reitz now. He reorganized. Many of the rabbanim who were studying in Reitz were going to Talmudic Academy. You follow? So, Yitzchak. Some of the students were much older. In other words, a kid who came from Europe who was 20 years old was graduating high school, but he was learning on a high level. But until 1919, all the kids who went to yeshiva and got smicha, most of their learning was in Europe. They came already a semi-finished product to America. Josh, now they learned in America. Until now, you went for smicha on the east side, you went to the Rabbani, you went to Reb Shalom Yaffa. You asked them for smicha. All right, who got smicha from Shalom Yaffa and who? Give me the name. Herbert S. Goldstein. He was a JTS graduate. No one can believe it today. I got an email. Wow, they can't believe Herbert S. Goldstein, JTS graduate. He was a JTS graduate. But he got smicha from Reb Shalom Yaffa. People went on the east side to Rabbanim Reb. They got private smicha. Now it was officially the yeshiva. But more than that, one of the five was an American-born youngster. And Salbi Friedman, Rabbi Friedman, who I yet knew, a lawyer, rabbi of Young Israel of Washington Heights, was in the first graduating class of the yeshiva of Reitz. Five young men, one of them American born. It's the first American born musmach of Yeshiva University of Reitz. Call it what wish. The Jewish Forum, which was now an Orthodox monthly put out in New York, I did research in many of the issues, Torah is on the map, stated in an editorial that the new rabbis, quote, equipped with a vast and intimate knowledge of the Torah in its broadest connotation and possessed of a real modern education, would succeed with both the un-Americanized and the already Americanized Jews. These were not only Orthodox rabbis in the full meaning of the term, but Americanized rabbis as well. The Chag HaSmicha was held at the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue, which itself was the apex of America, of modernity, the merger, the synthesis now between Spanish and Portuguese and the Ashkenaz. You know that after Pereira Mendes, the next rabbi was an Ashkenaz rabbi, Israel Gerstein. And after, who came after Pereira Mendes? One second, the Solar Pool. And after the Solar Pool, Louis Gerstein. If I said Israel a second ago, it's a different rabbi. I cross out Israel. He was Louis Gerstein. And here, Spanish, Portuguese, and Rabbi Shalom Yaffer is speaking, Ramaz is speaking, Rabbi Dr. Philip Klein, who we spoke about of Ohe Tzedek, is speaking. And of course, the main speaker is Rabbi Revel. And you have to understand, this was right after World War I. You could take his speech and think it was right after World War II, what we Jews have gone through. And that's why I get very angry when an Israeli politician worries what the world will think of us. Wow. Ubein goyim lo yitchashev. I quote Rabbi Revel. With bleeding hearts. Now Rabbi Revel was a wonderful speaker in English. He had a ghostwriter. I mean, here's a man who came to America 1906. Why did he know in English? But he learned English quickly, and he had a good head for languages. He had a ghostwriter who I yet interviewed, I yet knew. I'll tell you an embarrassing situation that happened to me. Joseph Shipley. He was on the original Yeshiva College faculty. I don't know whether he was Jewish. Maybe he was. Could be his father was Jewish, his mother not. Joseph Shipley. And he was Revel's ghostwriter, helped him speak, prepared his speeches. The embarrassing moment, I tell you this in parentheses, I go to interview him. He lived in a loft in Manhattan. And this woman is with him. And I'm a young rabbi, and I figure if a man lives with a woman, it has to be his wife. I say, why not? And I noticed they looked at me cross-eyed no one informed me it was his mistress, if I'm using the right term. I don't know, who needs marriage? Everyone lives together. It's a different world today, like monkeys in the zoo. But I remember I was embarrassed. I found out afterwards. I called her Mrs. Shipley, and I was committing a crime. Anyway, Joseph Shipley wrote his addresses, or polished his addresses, edited. He would give him the ideas. Professor Shipley told me Rabbi Revel would give him the ideas and he would work them out. With bleeding hearts, we have been witnessing for the last 5 years the destruction of almost all our great sanctuaries of Torah and Jewish learning in Europe and Palestine. Civilized barbarism run amok has wiped out the great centers of Torah and homes of the Jewish spirit, which have taken Judaism centuries to build. Blessed be the Almighty who has caused us to live, kept us, and enabled us to reach the significant and solemn occasion to behold the first fruit of the great Torah Center erected to the glory of the God of Israel and for the perpetuation of His Torah on this continent. Well, I don't think that needs any elaboration. It catches the moment. It catches the hour. And then you can see already the problem with what is developing as conservative Judaism. It's something that you young rabbis can't understand today. Of course, conservative Judaism is so distant from Torah today. It's Reform Judaism. It's all that differs is its institutional, I'll use the word initiatives, that you want to keep the institutions alive. It involves money and buildings and jobs, but there's very little difference. But at one time, conservative Judaism was dedicated to halacha. So they said, make a few innovations and you will attract the masses, you will attract the second generation and the third generation. And it was such a pull, such a lodestar, and it had influence that even these young men should not be captivated by it. May I address to you, my young friends who are about to enter your sacred calling as the Rabbanim in Israel, a word of advice. You have been raised on the knees of Torah, and you are worthy sons of the yeshiva. You have studied our holy Torah day and day and night for many a year. And Rabbi Rebbe goes on to describe the beauty of Torah, the depth of Torah. But then he says, may I remind you of the portion we read this week of the children of Aaron the high priest, who soon after their consecration to priesthood were consumed by a heavenly fire for bringing near the Lord, a strange fire that the Lord has not commanded them. And then he goes on and he talks about the strange fires in America, and he pleads with the young rabbis, don't be like the B'nai Aharon. Don't fall. Don't be captivated by fires that are alien to Torah and tradition. It's a beautiful address. It captures the moment. Tremendous achievement. The first yeshiva, advanced program, Smicha, 5 graduates. Salvi Friedman, I can remember him like yesterday, came from Pittsburgh, American born. One more point I want to make about this aspect of the development of yeshiva. I'll give you a document. I thank Seymour Kleiman, my student via the web, who sent me a copy of the letter. I knew a little bit about this because someone has been researching it, and I believe a book is coming out. Rabbi Dr. Nathan Affenbacher Ophir, if the name means anything to you. You see, what was happening? In Eretz Yisrael...
What's he writing about?
You'll see in a minute what I'm going to talk about. In Eretz Yisrael, a similar process was beginning. Rav Kook. One of Rav Kook's basic visions? We need a yeshiva capable of dealing with modernity, dealing with the new reality, dealing with Eretz Yisrael, dealing with Hebrew University, dealing with the Chalutzim, the Kibbutzim, dealing with the Chiloniyut, the secularization of the Israeli mentality by the secular Zionists who ruled the country. We all know the Aliyah Bet, 1904 to 1914, the second Aliyah, I shouldn't say Aliyah Bet, the second Aliyah is the Aliyah that shaped the country until today. When we struggle with where we're going, everyone recognizes what was can no longer be. Not for them and not for us. So Rabbi Kook had this tremendous vision, a new yeshiva, Merkaz Harav is what it's called. And Rabbi Kook's vision was not that different than what was happening in New York, except Rav Kook was viewing it in Palestinian context. What's interesting about Merkaz HaRav, that the idea never took off, not in Rabbi Cook's lifetime, and not immediately afterwards. The idea did take off and reached its apex following the Six-Day War, and Merkaz HaRav totally changed the entire reality of the Israeli situation. What came out of the guidance of that school, of their leaders, of their Rabbanim, of their Gedolei Yisrael, of their Rashi Yeshiva, the list is endless. Yeshiva high schools, Ulpanot, Michlalot, Yeshivat Hesda, total integration on the Israeli scene, total integration in the army. A book just came out that claims that there is a concentrated, premeditated movement on the part of the Kippot Strugot. Part of the title is the Strugah in the army, to take over the army, and by taking over the army, you take over the country. Now this book is totally, completely wrong. Totally. But there's a reality. The reality on the ground is that the Kippot have made tremendous strides. It's no longer a secular country. You saw in the election that that one party had one word to say against Torah Hashem, against religion. Gotta give credit. It didn't happen during Rav Cook's lifetime. But the results today, epic making. We face that challenge at this very moment. You have Yesh Atid, and you have Yesh Avar. I told you yesterday, any Talmud of mine who uses the word Agudat Yisrael or Shas will have to pay me two zuz fine. Yesh Avar. There's Yesh Atid and Yesh Avar. And we, Talmidei Talmidov of Rav Kook and Merkaz HaRav and Yeshiva University, we have to merge the two. We have to synthesize the two. There's beauty in both. Yeshavah, fabulous. We remain from Jews, Lamdanim, Gedolei Yisrael, Tzadikim, Hasidim. But Yesh Atid, the context of the new world. New adjectives, new dress, new deportment, new configuration, but the basic individual is one and the same. Shalshelet HaKabbalah, one and the same. How is Shabbat, Kashrut, Tarut, Mishpacha, our way of life, no different than that of our parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, as distant as they were from Eretz Yisrael, modernity, and all that we have today. Wow. What a compliment to the Torah people that we have gone further and gone further in dignity. With all the heartache, with all the foolishness, with all the Chilul Hashem, sometimes you use words, Goyim, Nevela, Nevelot, Trefat. Wow. What's being thrown around? I like the way Rakefet says it. Yesh Atid v'Yesh Avar. And we have to bridge into a magnificent future, which is going to happen. Be'ito achishena. If we're intelligent and great, we'll do it quicker. If not, it will happen more gradually. Rabbi Revel and Rabbi Cook got to know each other. When? A young guy, Arnie Rothkopf, won $50 his junior year in Yeshiva College. Why, Josh, do you know why? Tell the class. Don't be shy.
Sure, for the Rabbanim.
they offered a $50 kala kavod that someone reads my books and takes me seriously. Thank you. Thank you. Kala kavod. They offered a $50 prize to original research in American Jewish history. And because I knew Rav Lessen, and Rav Lessen a number of times spoke about his trip to America in 1924 as the shamus of the Levush Mordechai, the Slabodka Rosh Yeshiva, so I was always intrigued by this visit. So I did research, and we'll come to it in detail, it's not for now, on the Central Relief and their visit, $1 million campaign, 1924, for the support of the yeshivat in Palestine and Europe. Who did they bring to America? All right, the Levush Mordechai, Slabodka Rosh Yeshiva, the Kovner Rav, the Deva Avraham, Rav Avram Dovber, Kahana Shapiro, and the chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. Rabbi Revel got to know Rabbi Cook. He visited the yeshiva, spoke in the yeshiva. All the rabbim in America turned out to honor them. Affairs were held all over New York. Fundraisers all over New York. They got to know each other. They had a dream, and the dream, by the way, was mutual. I found on both sides of the ocean the same vision. To a certain degree, I have to tell you, Rabbi Steve Riskin had the same vision. I don't know, I'm pretty sure he didn't view it in the context of history and what I'm saying right now. He had the same dream. Why you and Mechaz HaRav? It's more than a local institution. It's a worldwide concept. We Torah Jews have to reinvent ourselves, regenerate ourselves, put on new adjectives, dress up differently. We're coming in to a new world. Let's cooperate with each other. And we actually have a letter from Rabbi Revel to Chief Rabbi Cook. You will find it in a volume, and this is what Seymour Kleinman sent me, and I appreciate it. Igrot L'Riyah, not letters that Rav Cook wrote, but letters to Rav Cook. Look at letter Resh Het Vav, 1927. Hold Kvod Yedidi, Yedid Hashem Vanashim V'Yedid Nafshi, Your Honorable, look at the way Rav Revel addresses Rav Cook. Yedid Hashem, and that you're beloved by God and people, and you're my personal friend. Hagon Hamiti, Moradi Aradi Yisrael, Kvod Shein Tifato, Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, Shalom Uvracha Ad Olam. It's a fabulous letter. All right, you can read it. It's Rabbinic Hebrew. But I want to come to the gist of the letter. We have this tremendous institution in America. You have visited. You know what it's about. I hear wonderful things of what you're starting to do in Israel. Why don't we join forces together? Gentlemen, you're sitting here. Listen to this. Why don't we have student exchange? We will send some of our students to study with your yeshiva in Yerushalayim, and you send some of your students to study with us. We will exchange faculty. We will send some of our Rashi yeshiva to lecture in Eretz Yisrael, in Merkaz Harav, and we want you to send some of your Rosh Yeshiva to lecture in Yeshiva University. What today is Yeshiva Shabbat, it's before Yeshiva University. It's 1927. And very fascinating. And he says, I understand that you're preparing rabbis to go into the diaspora. Well, they'll need English. And if that's the case, we can help. Yuchlu lemalei b'yeshiva 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 b'yeshi חיסרון השפה בתוך יתר הדברים, ולא יבושו כי ידברו את אויביהם בשער. Rabbi Revel's writing a beautiful rabbinic Hebrew, quoting a pasuk. They won't be ashamed when they have to deal with their adversaries in the public thoroughfare. They need the English language. If they come to Yeshivas Mishal Chanan, they will be exposed to English. Baruch HaTolam Aruch Olam Shekol Yevet Drau. He ends off the letter, and I end off this part of the class. He says, it's not only an idea. It's not only my idea. I spoke it over with some of the most important leaders of the Torah community in America. Two of them are coming to visit Palestine this summer. And I asked them to speak with you to make this idea practical and to implement it. And who are the two people? The most important rabbi in the United States, Reb Moshe Zvulun Margoliet, known to you as Ramaz, and the leading balabas in the United States, the man who single-handedly built a great deal of Torah, Harry Fishel. They are coming. They're going to be in Palestine, and they have every authorization from me to finalize whatever they can of this vision. I need not tell you that Harry Fishel, Aaron Tzvi Fishel in Hebrew, he builds for Rav Kook that beautiful building which is a landmark in Rehov Rav Kook in the center of town. That was Rav Kook's home. That was the seat of the chief rabbinate. That was the yeshiva. That was the Beis Medrash. That was built by Harry Fishel, and all happened during this visit. Harry Fishel also, this might have happened in an earlier visit, but one day I'm going to go into Harry Fishel in detail. I'll give you the exact date. I have it in my notes already. On his visit to Palestine, he went to Europe, went to visit his hometown, built the Talmud Torah there, went to visit the Chafetz Chaim. And it's Harry Fishel, the story that everyone tells about the Chafetz Chaim, it is with Harry Fishel. It's a true story. Harry Fishel, who was a very generous individual, and before 1929, as his grandson wrote to me here, Aaron Reichel, and I knew this, but I like the way he writes it. He said, before the stock market crash, my grandfather could do anything. Money was not a factor. Then, with the real estate and all that happened, afterwards, it's not that he was a poor man, but he was not on the level that he could do whatever he wanted. So he sees the Chafetz Chaim's home, a few broken chairs, and he says, Rebbe, I want to build for you a beautiful house. It should be a covered, people should walk in. You know, he wanted to turn the Chafetz Chaim into Rishon, into Malchut, Chassidus. And by the way, the new Rishon Rebbe in the Haredi Press, they describe him as a Rishon Amiti, quote, end quote. His dignity, his deportment, this is Rishon. They walk a certain way. Rishon is Rishon. Rakefet could never be Rishon. It's not within his ability, but he understands Rishon. I understand it. I'll take that much credit. So the Chafetz Chaim said to him, Mr. Fishel, when you travel, do you have the luxury of your home in New York? He says, no, I have to put up with a hotel, whatever I have. He says, I'm also traveling. This is the prosdor to Olam Haba. And he says, I hope when I'm traveling, I can't have all I'm going to have in the world to come. So I'm very satisfied with this furniture. Quote, end quote. That was the Chafetz Chaim. My dear friends, the best is yet to come. Next week's class, anyone who comes to class gets $36,000 from the Rebbe on the IOU list, because I'm convinced that if you hear next week's class, you will never do a sin the rest of your lives. Even you should live to be 240, you will never sin. You will be filled with Torah and Yirat Shemayim. It's You're very Etzem Hashem, as we said an hour and a half ago. And it's, I guarantee it, 36 grand gift from the Rebbe. For Sunday's class, when I deal with the Valvadi Yosef, Pe'er Hadar, and a little of tradition, and then into Reb Heschel Shechta, you owe the Rebbe 36 to the IOU list for coming. So Baruch Hashem will be okay. To reiterate, what did we do today? First of all, we said a few words on Rabbi David Hartman, and I leave it open. 50 years from now, we'll reconvene and see about the Shem Etzem. Yehi Zichro Baruch. It's a world that I grew up in, that nurtured me, and that world, unfortunately, is rapidly disappearing. We then went into Rabbi Revel, Talmudical Academy. Don't forget the name Shelley Safir. You will see why. Talmudical Academy, 1919, the first graduation. Teachers Institute, the Pandora's box is opened. Reads the first Chag HaSmicha, Rabbi Revel's charge to the young rabbis, Salbi Friedman, Mekaz HaRav, Rabbi Revel, and Rav Cook. My dear students, I have the pleasure of a student has just entered the classroom, who was my student, I think, before some of you were born, Dr. Baruch Kastner, or Bernie, and I want to honor him with a copy of my new book, and it reads the Talmidei HaYakar, Dr. Baruch Kastner, Bevrachat Hamat L'Shanim Rabot Shel Nahorim Alia Urbayut HaGuf Bahava Rabba Aaron Rakefet Rosh Chodesh Adar Tashag. But Bernie doesn't take a gift from the Rebbe. We're going to trade, as you will see. And Bernie, here, come forward, and let's give you a little publicity so the books sell. You understand? It's not enough to publish. Oh, wow.
I have to inscribe it into
the... No, you'll do it, you'll do it. First of all, we'll do the serious book. Ha'olam She'acharei Al-Pi HaMakorot V'Sipurim Ishiyim. And this is a translation of what you published in English? No?
No, separate.
That's separate, and this...
That's to come. Now this year there will be another release.
And you're dealing here. There are reasons why my good friend Dr. Bernie, my student, he had a personal tragedy. It was a son, right? And to lose a child is very hard. And he created tremendous nechama by dealing with life beyond this tangible world. And I look forward to going through. I see you have old Makorot of Chazal, and do you go? I see what you have here, and you go through Zohar. Oh wow, you're ahead of me. I'm not young enough. I'm not old enough to study Zohar. I'm still young. Okay.
Well, okay. Before you go to the other book, I just wanted to express my hakarat hatov to my dear Rebbe Harav Aaron Rakefet. Back in 1975-76, I was privileged to be a Talmud here for a year in BMT, and I'll never forget that year. Since then, we've been in touch. A few years ago, I attended some of your shiurim, but because of my time limitations, unfortunately...
Before you started making a living here.
Right. thank God we made Aliyah 18 years ago, and about... When was it, a year and a half, 2 years ago, when you were sitting Shiva for your mother?
My mother, it's a little over a year.
A
year and a few months already,
so
wow.
When I paid a Shiva called Harav Rakefet, we were talking, and you mentioned his new book, and I had just published the book that Rav Rakefet has in his hands right now, which is a book on baseball. And I didn't think it was really appropriate at the time, while paying a Shiva call, to really go into... that book, but I know that Rav Rakefet has an intense interest in baseball. Some of his famous shirim are sviv baseball, and what we can learn from certain aspects and attributes of certain players. But I promised Rav Rakefet that at some point afterwards that I would return and present him not only with that book, but with my newest book that came out about a month and a half ago. This book is sort of night and day compared to this one. It's a very humorous outlook on 1 year when I played in a softball league.
In 1985, in a
non-Jewish softball league in Brooklyn, and I compared my experiences playing in that league versus the Jewish league that I played in, and the Young Israel League. And I hope you'll enjoy it.
It's
when you have a little time when you're not learning or giving over a share, it's a quick read. But I really thank the Reverend Kev for the opportunity to coming here, because I really do believe I have a message that I would like to get out there in terms of the books that I've published. This is the third book on the subject of the afterlife, and basically what it deals with is the journey that our neshama takes in Olam Haba. This particular book, the sources are based totally on the Zohar.
And Chazal, I saw Chazal
and
Zohar.
Yeah, Chazal, but mostly what I did was I went through the 23 krachim of the Zohar according to the Perush of the Matok Midvash.
Right.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Right.
Of course, I had some help. I didn't do it on my own. And over the course of a number of years, I put together, based on a number of different subjects, the journey that happens after we leave this world. And in between, my co-author here also put in all kinds of wonderful, wonderful, inspirational stories of people who had a near-death experience. And how it affected their lives. Many people who were Chilonim and became Balei Tshuva as a result, those sort of things. This book actually was supposed to come out after the book that's going to be coming out in English this year, called Back to the Afterlife. And that book is based on a combination of Zohar and a lot of other Kabbalistic sources.
I remember in the original book you had general sources as well.
Right, this one goes a lot deeper. But it's also based on the research of a hypnotherapist called Dr. Michael Newton in the States. And what he did was, over 10, 15 years ago or so, he interviewed over 1,000 of his patients under hypnotic regression. And he brought them back to a previous lifetime. And he asked them, slowly, under hypnosis, to go to their day of death, and then to describe to him, as they're crossing over from this life into the next life, what happened to them. And he wrote a number of books that were bestsellers, sold 3-4 million copies of exactly their experiences in the afterlife. Wonderful, wonderful, interesting research. And when I read it, I realized that there was something missing there from my own little knowledge of what we have to say about the afterlife. And then I found, as I was going through our sources, that there were things missing in our sources that were in Newton's research. So that was really the basis of the next book that's coming out. And I put it together in my own way, from my own understanding. And there what I did was I had a sequential order of the journey that our neshama takes from 30 days before one dies, step by step, as it crosses over into the afterlife, what happens, until the next Gilgul.
Very nice, very nice. I just want to say one word. Out of my league, and you see what happens. This is a person, a Rebbe. To be a Rebbe, every human being lives in three different shifts. You live Shia Shirim, then you live Mishle, then you live Kohelet. For a Rebbe, that is impossible. You'll be a very bad Rebbe, because your students from the 60s will be Shia Shirim people. Your students from the 70s, 80s will be Mishle people. Those already later on will be Kohelet people, and that's not good. So a good Rebbe, the Gemara in Chagiga, it's a fabulous Gemara, says him, Harav domeh l'malech l'mad Torah mipiv. If not, you can't. Ki malech Hashem tzvakatu. They quote a pasuk from Malachi. Rebbe has to be like an angel. How can a Rebbe be like an angel? But it means time has no effect on an angel. A Rebbe has to be like an angel, that time has no effect. And he has to live together, Shir HaShirim, Mishlei Kohelet. The minute he matures from 21 on, 18 on, all three periods interact. And that way the Rebbe is balanced, any racist students that are balanced. So I want to say, sitting in front of you, this is Shir HaShirim, that's Kohelet, and Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll combine it and come out of it with Mishlei. A few freebies, 1 second before we... And Yitzchak, I have a question I want to ask you. This is for Yitzchak. If anyone is interested about Kiddush clubs in America, it is unbelievable what's going on. Rebbeinu Shel Olam, it tells you which disappeared in the Wall Street Journal. I have two copies of it. It tells you which shul to daven in Shabbos if you want the top whiskey available. If you have any love for Chabad and Torah and the Yesh Ava v'Yesh Atid, this is about the sons of the two chief rabbis of Tzfat, the Ashkenazi rabbi and the Sfadik rabbi, and their two sons are in the same unit in the army. This is about Ed Koch, Satman, the Lubavitcher Rebbe's police protection. I never left more. There was a police car outside 770. I used to see it whenever I went there. And then there was an outcry, why are you wasting money having a police car? So everyone told Mayor Koch, it's probably to protect the Chabad Jews from the blacks because Chabad didn't leave all the other Jews around. Koch did an investigation. You know why the police car was there? To protect the Lubavitcher Rebbe from the Satmar Hasidim. Okay? And finally, this I want to give, Bernie, this is for you. These kids don't even start to understand this. Did you see the New York Times on Lou Gehrig on Pride of the Yankees? So, okay, who played Lou Gehrig on Pride of the Yankees? Gary Cooper. What was the problem? Gary Cooper was right-handed. Lou Gehrig was left-handed. How did they do the film to show him as a left-hander like Lou Gehrig? Wait till you see the theories. There's a Machlokes Rambam and the Ravid with the Drei with the Kesef Mishnah. It's unbelievable. My dear students, we should only... wait a minute. Those of you who have your wives read Hebrew, Nashim, I can't get over how they can come up with a magazine so glossy, beautiful, and I'll sneer it, and Yirat Shemayim. And finally, Recipes, a gourmet magazine. I can't believe what goes on in this world. No wonder we have different adjectives. But the Shem Etzem remains the same. Until we meet again in health and happiness, das vidanya. Yitzchak, I give you a gift if you can tell me who this rabbi is. The one at the end. Everyone else, we write them.